Good afternoon, and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from our offices overlooking San Francisco's Financial District. I'm Stephanie Salter, San Francisco Examiner columnist, and your quarterly chair. We also welcome the listeners of WSQGFM 90.9 in Ithaca, New York, one of more than 225 radio stations around the nation carrying America's longest-running radio program. As you know, today's program is a conversation format, which means we have two guests to introduce. The first is our interviewer. Film and theater critic Jan Wall has worn almost as many career hats as she has worn her trademark Real Thing hats. Her previous jobs include everything from owning a movie memorabilia shop to directing and stage managing The Lawrence Welk Show. Really. She's also an Emmy Award winner, which she got for writing and directing a humorous documentary on the infamous palimony case of Lee Marvin and Michelle Triola. And she was one of the first women members of the Screen Directors Guild, for which she says she is truly still proud and still a member. Ms. Wall's reviews and truly informational dish can be seen in five different time slots on four different days on KRON Channel 4 TV, heard twice a day each Monday, Wednesday, and Friday on KCBS Radio, and read weekly in the Marin Scope newspapers. Ladies and gentlemen, the gorgeous Jan Wall. And lucky for us here this afternoon in this packed room that Jan is about to interview one of the giants of the international stage, a man for whom words like legendary, nonpareil, and totally awesome are understatements. Before I begin his biography, though, I must apologize for anything I do to French pronunciation. It's taken me weeks of practice to stop saying mime and saying mime. Mm. Marcel Marceau's name has been synonymous with the art of mime for five decades. Born in Strasbourg, France in 1923, he was inspired as a child to silent acting by the pre-talkies films of such artists as Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, and Harold Lloyd. Studying with mime master Etienne Decroux at Charles Dulin's School of Dramatic Art in Paris, he perfected his technique and created one of the world's most enduring and endearing characters, his everyman, Bip. Monsieur Marceau formed his own company in 1948 and began to tour the globe, performing 26 mimodramas that he produced, directed, and played. His first U.S. tour was an unqualified knockout in 1955-56. There is no continent and barely a country on earth in which he has not performed. Monsieur Marceau has won two Emmys and has been decorated with every imaginable government and academic accolade, including France's Legion of Honor and an honorary doctorate from Princeton University. He has acted with Jane Fonda in Barbarella, and he spoke the only word in Mel Brooks's film Silent Movie. The word was no. The kudos heaped upon Monsieur Marceau comprise a veritable Mont Blanc of praise. Here are just two from reviews of his current show at San Francisco's Theater on the Square. Robert Hurwitt of my paper, The Examiner, noted, "Age cannot wither him. It only seems to have refined his economy of gesture and amplified the expressiveness of his remarkably elastic face." Said the Chronicle critic, Octavio Roca, "Marcel Marceau is a miracle, and his first appearance in San Francisco in 15 years is an exhilarating triumph. Lithe and spry at 76, androgynous and lovely, the great French mime creates plays without text, music out of silence. Most of all, Marceau creates beauty. So, mesdames et messieurs, le très beau Marcel Marceau." Oh.
All right. How does it work? Like this?
Okay, yeah, and they will judge it by our voice. They'll be able to fix it fine. All right, it is so nice to have you here. I am so excited to be talking to you. I saw you many times as I was growing up in Los Angeles. My mother was hoping her three girls would learn the value of silence. And the artistry of it as well. I'd like to go right to, because we were talking off stage, we were talking about Charles Laughton and Gary Cooper and Red Skelton and all these people that came to see you when you first came to America. Why don't we start there? It's such an exciting place.
Well, it's true. When I came in America in 55, it was exactly 10 years after the war. And I played in New York for 2 weeks, and then we extended. We played at the Ethel Barrymore Theater at the New York City Center. We stayed 6 months. And then I played in Hollywood. And all Hollywood were there, what I call Hollywood, from the Marx Brothers to Gary Cooper, Charles Laughton, all the great stars, you know, when Hollywood was really Hollywood, and the encounter was absolutely fantastic. And I will tell you something which struck my mind. Charles Laughton had seen me in New York when I played at the Ethel Barrymore Theater. He came 4 or 5 times. And when I was in Hollywood, of course, he made a great party. And he said to me, "You know, I did not invite Grace Kelly because I don't know, I don't like her so much." And I said, "But what happened?" He said, "I told her as an excuse that my kitchen was too small." This was the kind of humor he had, you know. But then, when I was entering, all Hollywood was there, as I said before. He said, "Marcel, do you want to meet Gary Cooper?" And of course, I was 30, 31 years old, something like this. And of course, to meet all the Hollywood stars was an event. And I went to Gary Cooper, and Charles says to him, "Gary, Marcel wants so much to meet you." And then he stands up, very tall, and he says, "Does he speak English?" And I say, "Yes." He said, "Oh," and he sits down. And of course, the Marx Brothers was fantastic. Harpo came to see the show, yes. And he said, "Marcel, I want to enter your company because I don't work anymore with my brother like before." You know, it was 55. They did not work together. They loved one another, sure. But it was no more the time of the great movie they did in the
30s.
Oh, yeah, in the 30s, 40s. But when I was 14 years old, I saw all the Marx Brothers movies. And he said to me, "I want to enter your company." I said, "What an honor, but we cannot pay you, you know." But he knew exactly it was also a joke, I said. But then he came and invited me and the man who was my assistant at the time, a young man too, and he played harp for us. And there was no reporter, nobody. It was absolutely intimate. I don't imagine today it would be the same. No. Because you would have all reporters coming and making pictures. And really, he played. It was wonderful. And I remember also I was invited I played chess with Hollywood actors. There was a great family in the same time and a great respect they had for the art, which was completely new to them, because America, what could you bring in America which America did not have in 55? They had the greatest dancers, the greatest musical comedies, they saw the greatest films, they had the greatest symphony orchestras, they have everything in art, you see, great museums too, the biggest artists from the whole world. I brought silence on the stage.
Yes.
But not a silence which is sad, because for people, silence, people are frightened about silence, and I say silence does not exist, because there is a stream which goes, and you feel the weight of the soul. when you are lyrical, you have just to be involved. And people say, I'm so happy he doesn't talk, you know.
Mm-hmm. See, yeah, it's a relief.
Yes, because we enter in a certain mystery, uh-huh. You see, because we have all moments of silence. And silence does not exist because when a writer wants to write, he has to have silence. When a musician prepares, he has to be silent first. Silence is really the departure of everything.
And it is a mystery because we bring ourselves to it, our own background, our old baggage to it.
Yes, and then I say what I learned from Hollywood is a great simplicity these great stars had. They were not at all the way I am, mm-hmm. You know, I was a theater man, mm-hmm. And there were stars known in the whole world. I was just Marcel Marceau in the theater.
Right.
But what I brought also on stage is walking against the wind, and there was no wind. Going upstairs and downstairs, no stairs.
Right.
And I brought the visible through the invisible. And this is why, maybe this was the reason where I caught really the imagination of the people, because sometimes less is more.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Jimmy Cagney always said, just look the other guy in the face and tell him the truth. And Cooper would look down and kick a piece of dirt. I mean, so it was that kind of simplicity. But we had Chaplin, we had Keaton. That was silent.
Yes, I met Chaplin, and this was a fantastic story. I don't know if you are interested to know.
Would you like to hear about Chaplin? I think they would.
You know, it was in 67, and I had to make my entrance in Paris for a big show, and I got a telephone from Vadim, who was married to
Jane Fonda.
And preparing Barbarella, who is a cult film today. And Vadim was with me during the occupation in Paris in the drama school, which we were together in the drama school. And of course, we were friends. And then after the war, he became a big star for movie making.
Right, directing.
And I did pantomime, and he calls me Marcel. I do Barbarella. Would you just have? I have something for you, the role of Professor Ping in Barbarella. I said, okay. How long is it? Because I have a show. Well, it will take 1 week, shooting. Okay. And the day I go to the airport, I see a man walking. He had a brown head walking, and four, five kids behind him. Like little poussin. You know what poussin is in French?
Chicken? No.
No, the children of chicken.
Oh, the children. Okay. Well,
how do you call it in English?
Uh-huh.
Poussin.
Little chicks
yes.
Behind him. Okay.
They were behind him. He was walking like this.
Thank God, I went to a few restaurants in my life.
I said, Charlie Chaplin, my God. I'm not going to run after him and ask an autograph. Then I was taking orange juice on the bar before the plate arrives, and my cousin says to me, Marcel, Charlie Chaplin looks at you. I said, don't kid, he doesn't look at me. And I said, I did this, you know, to see if it was true, you know. And I was with a reporter of Match, the French Match, you know.
It's the magazine.
It's like Life in America.
Right.
And also a movie maker who wanted to make a reportage on Marcel Marceau playing in Barbarella with Jane Fonda. And when they saw that I was going to see Chaplin, they said, we come with you. I said, no, please stay. I don't want Chaplin to think that I want to make my publicity. I regret it, no. And then I came directly to him, and then he said, oh, Marcel Marceau, I have not recognized you. I saw you always with a white face. I said, okay. And I was very, suddenly, I had no words anymore. What could I say meeting Chaplin, you know? And then there was a moment, I said, you know, you are my God. When I was a child, I imitated you in the streets. I stole the bonnet of my father, his shoes, and I was miming Chaplin. And then I said, and I started miming Chaplin, and he was miming Chaplin too. And both we were walking. And my reporter said, my God, what a scoop he could have had. And now I regret this moment. But what was important is this. He said, children, come and meet Marcel Marceau. And then we talked, but you know, what could you say to Chaplin? That he's great, he's wonderful, he's God, he's godly. And there was a moment, Ona, who was a wonderful person, I could see very reserved, but very calm. She said, Charlie, we have to take the plane for Vevey. And I said to myself, what can I do to thank this man? And then I took his hand, and I wanted to kiss his hand. And then he had a moment where I forced the hand and kissed him. And this moment, he was... And I said to myself, if I say to people that Chaplin was almost crying because I kissed his hand, people will say, how pretentious he is, Marcel Marceau, to say that. I have to keep it for myself. But when I went in Rome with Vadim, I said to Vadim, Vadim, let me tell you frankly, I kissed the hand of Chaplin and he had tears in his eyes. Why? Because you are Marcel Marceau. No, no, don't say that. He is Chaplin. Then he said, let me tell you a story, Marcel. And Vadim is a very cultured man. He has read very much about Renaissance, antiquity, everything. He said, you know, let me tell you why he cried. Oh, not cried, really, why he had tears in his eyes. A little like he had the expression of the end of City Lights, you know, when he sees the flower girl.
The blinded, and yeah, yes, she's not blinded.
It was wonderful. Then he says to me, at the epoch of the Renaissance in Rome, Michelangelo was 76. And people said at the time, his old hat. So long, a sculptor, you know. Now people were speaking about Raphael, 18 years old, a genius in painting. But then Raphael goes in a church and sees Michelangelo sculpting. He sees Michelangelo, he falls on his knees and kisses the feet of Michelangelo. Raphael kisses the feet of Michelangelo. And Michelangelo takes him and starts crying. You know why? Because Raphael represented the new generation who recognized him, you see. And it is possible, and Vadim wanted to tell me, that when I kissed the hand of Chaplin, I represented all my generation. Because at that time, nobody recognized Chaplin. Because there was not one person who asked an autograph to him. When he was 30 years old, 100,000 people. You see, like Michael Jackson, like the Beatles, you know, 100,000 people. Nobody recognized him. And then the fact that, you see, he had no more the time before him like before. There are different reasons.
Sure.
But what he tells about Michelangelo and Raphael is very interesting.
It is. It was a huge compliment to Chaplin in his own way. It seems the character of Bip reminds me of the Little Tramp, the Chaplin character. Was there some influence there from the Little Tramp
for Bip? Well, to be very honest, first, let me tell you why I call my character Bip. It comes from Pip, Great Expectations by Dickens. And when you are 20 years old, you have great expectations.
Ah.
Instead of saying Pip, I said Bip. And then I did not know, then in the 60s, I opened the paper, France Soir, and I see Bip, beep, beep, the whole world is listening to you. It was a Sputnik.
Oh, okay.
Okay, I knew someone was going to bring up Children of Paradise, the film, which you did as a young man. It's a classic movie, and someone here would like to know what was your work, what was it like about doing Children of Paradise, and how was it embraced in France?
Let me be very honest. I did not play in Children of Paradise. But in 1943, Children of Paradise was shot in Nice. It was still the occupation, and it was in the French underground.
You were in the French underground.
Yes. But after the war, when Paris was liberated in June 1944, in December 1944, I engaged myself in the French First Army. And I fought side by side with the American GIs. I want you to know that because it's important in my life. But in 1946, when I was liberated, then Barrault, Jean-Louis Barrault, who played Pierrot in Les Enfants du Paradis, asked me to play Harlequin because he produced Baptiste, the pantomime he did in Les Enfants du Paradis. He played it in the theater in Paris. And I played with him in Paris in the theater, but not in the film. But it's all right. It would have been a great honor to play in that film. But I was at that time, I was 19, 20 years old.
Right.
And
What did you specifically do in the underground?
Excuse me?
In the French underground, what was your specific duty in the underground?
Well, my specific duty was, first of all, false identity cards for people who needed it. But good cards, because there were cards which were not good cards and other which were good. Good cards were when the people, when the Germans occupied Paris, or even, unfortunately, Vichy, the French
Vichy
who collaborated,
right,
called to know if the card was, if they had a suspicion for a person. The person could be Jewish or in the underground. Then they called at the mairie. How do you say? Is it right, mairie? Mairie is when
they
you have a mayor.
The no. mayor, yeah, the
yes,
Lord mayor,
yes.
they would call, who was part of the Vichy
yes.
government.
Is Mr. Dupont really born? Is it? And they had people in the underground who were in some mairies. And then there were the good cards, and I had a good card. And then, of course, I did also false people when they were 19, 20 had to go in Germany to work. Terrible, you know?
Labor camps?
Because we had no army then.
Oh, I see.
It was le travail forcé. And I did false card changing the years.
Oh.
You see?
Yeah.
And also sometimes bring children in Switzerland, Jewish children who were in a position to be deported. This was my job. But at the same time, I was in the art school in Limoges, but we learned not to speak to people. You see, it's very important because you could be, people can be collaborateurs and
collaborators.
Yeah, you have to learn not to speak. You understand? You can speak about weather, you can speak about food, about, and we had not real food at this time. It was terrible, you know. But we could not speak really about your life and not say anything about what we were doing. Because it was dangerous, you see. But When you asked me this question, I said this was my job during the war. Yes.
You mentioned that you have a special place in your heart for American GIs.
Well, this was a fantastic episode in my life, too. I was liaison with the 6th or 7th Army, Patton, who was located in Frankfurt. Because I spoke English. And there was a Captain Parker who was a wonderful captain. He had great respect because he asked me, "What are you doing?" I will be the student. Said, "I am a student for the theater. I want to be a mime." He said, "But what is mime, really?" I said, "Playing without talking, like Chaplin did in films, or Keaton." I said, "Oh, that's so, what do you do, really?" I said, "I have exercises like walk against the wind, going upstairs, downstairs, doing tug of war, showing life of a man from the cradle to the grave, but also funny numbers and a Japanese pantomime," because I was very creative at that time. And he said, "Could you make a show for the GIs?" Because I was myself in the French army, first French army, which was called Rhin et Danube, the Rhine and the Danube, to go from the Rhine until Austria, in Hungary, the Danube. And then he said to me, "Could you play for the GIs? We have a big tent, 2,000 GIs. What do you think? We have music, but you could play for 1 hour for the GIs." I said, "Oh, it would be wonderful." And I played for the GIs, and I had my first article in the Stars and Stripe. When what I say, you can look after that, you know. When you lie in life, it always goes back to you, the lie. When you say the truth, better say the truth, because this is really true. And I know I told that story, and people made research about it. And I am in the Stars and Stripe of 45.
I'm married to an ex-officer.
I know. Let me tell you another story, which is funny.
Oh yes, go ahead.
Is it all right?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you if you ever met Patton.
No.
My husband will kill me if I don't ask this.
Did you? But let me tell you a story which happened to me. It was April 45, because I was doing the war. In March, we entered Germany with the American GIs, because there was a counter-offensive with Rundstedt, which was very dangerous to Alsace-Lorraine, had been taken, and the Germans did a counter-offensive. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we pushed them away, and in January, February, we entered Germany. In April, the end was near, because Hitler committed suicide in April. But at that time, it was before we knew that it was the end of the war, it was beginning of April, and I discussed with a friend of mine, we were in French uniform, of course, and he was a philosopher. And we said, "What shall we do after the war?" He said, "I want to write books, because philosophy is so important, because there is Heidegger in Germany, there is Sartre in France, and I want to write about these 5 years of oppression." And I said to him, "Oh yes, and I will create a mime theater." And suddenly we enter the forest and we see 60 Germans. And we were not prepared, you know, because it was so quiet. It was a quiet day, you know. And my friend says to me, "We have to return. We have no weapons." I had just my a revolver here, but no, because I was under sous-officier. I don't know the word in English. Aspirant. This is sous-lieutenant. And I said to my friend, "We cannot do it. We have to advance. They have seen us." And fortunately, they were sitting, and I said, "They are tired. They want to surrender, certainly." And then we advanced both, and two lieutenant German of the Wehrmacht, they were not SS, they were Wehrmacht, said, "We want to surrender. Our men are hungry." And I say, "Okay, everybody has to put hands here, and with the guns, no." And then I went back with 40 or 50 militaries, to like Chaplin when he did Chaplin as a soldier and fighting the Germans in 1418. I don't know if you saw that film. And everybody in the Quartier Général were looking right, like this. Right. We were two, and there were 50 Germans.
Yeah.
And I said, it's funny because it was like a movie, you know?
Right.
Yeah. This was the funny part
of
it.
That's fantastic.
We were a little frightened, I must say.
Yeah.
But
you were the hero. Big hero.
Well,
oh, that's
no,
amazing.
No, because this is a story which can be used as a pantomime, you know?
Right. And you're talking about the Chaplin movie, The Great Dictator, where he plays both the barber, the Jewish barber, and also he plays a Adolf Hitler character in it. So, yeah, that sounds like something he would do.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
No, but he did a film also, which was Charlot Soldat.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a tree. And when the Germans arrived, boom, you know.
Right.
You don't remember
that
film?
I don't know that one.
Yeah, it's a wonderful film,
too.
Oh,
it's Chaplin, yes.
Yes.
Now we have to move all the way to Mel Brooks. This is a really big jump. And it's about silent movie. Someone wants you to talk about working within that structure of the movie. Silent movie, which is a movie about a company called Engulf and Devour that wants to take over the world. Very relevant film.
This was another story. This happened in 76. I got a telephone call. I was on tour in America every 2 years, so all America, not only the big university towns, but also the legitimate theaters. I was on television with Johnny Carson, and very often, and I would say, really, it was fantastic to have this communication with the American public. And then Mel Brooks calls me and says, Marcel, I'm doing a film called Silent Movie, and I want you to play it, but you will be the only person who will speak. I said, what? What will I say? Oh, don't worry. You just say no. I said, this is not a long speech. Is it all? He said, yes, you will be as Beep with a white face, with your top hat and the flower, and it happens that all the stars who play in it, Paul Newman, Burt Reynolds, and there were other actors who were famous at the time and still are.
Wow. Anne Bancroft and Sid Caesar and wonderful people. Anne Bancroft was in it?
Yes, of course.
Sid Caesar.
But you will see then he says, listen, I must speak to you frankly. And this I like in America. You have to speak out frankly and not to be hypocritical. You have to, not just to be nice, you have to say the truth. And I said to him, listen, to say no, just no. Anybody can say no, and anybody could have put on my white makeup. The public will be disappointed if he doesn't see at least a pantomime. If you say he's the greatest mime in the world, they say, because it's silent. They were written like in the old film. What do I do? You see, we have to find a pantomime before I say no. Mm-hmm. I said, Marcel, you are right. Let me think about it. I call you back in 2 hours. And in 2 hours he calls me back and he says, you know, all the artists who had to play in that film, one has a broken leg, the other cannot play, and you have to have somebody who plays in this film. Then I have an idea. When the telephone rings, there's a big storm in Paris, the window is open, the wind goes in, and you walk against the wind, not able to reach the telephone. And you make a whole pantomime. Did you see the film? Yes. Yeah. You make a whole pantomime before reaching the telephone, and you almost fall from the window, you know. It was a whole pantomime. And, of course, then he says, no. And then there was another word. What did he say? I don't know. I don't speak French. But it was written, though. This was a story about silent films. But there was also another film. I did another film with Bill Castle called Shanks.
Right. William Castle directed it, who was quite well known in Hollywood for kind of B-movies.
It was a 20th century, Paramount.
Mm-hmm.
But this also another story. It was not a success when it came out. It was a success in the theater, but Bill Castle did horror films. But here he tried to do a poetic film. And you know, and they were not accustomed to see Bill Castle making a poetic film.
Mm-hmm.
And the critics say Marcel Marceau does not need to have props. He can do everything without nothing. I didn't like it too to say this. But you know, sometimes people see you in a certain way and they don't accept you and you are different. But it became a cult film in the universities and many young people, and it goes around still today.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Castle, I don't know if you know the name of Bill Castle, he did many horror films, but he was a wonderful man also. And it was fun to play in Hollywood with Paramount, you know.
Ah, absolutely wonderful. Well, you're an actor and a mime. I mean, do you like to be, you're called an actor. Correct? I mean, Sir Anthony Hopkins says he learned from two people only in his career, Sir Laurence Olivier and Marcel Marceau.
Who said this?
Anthony Hopkins. This is
yes.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
Not bad.
No, it's true. I must say that American people, American artists have great simplicity. They don't play stars at the time. They had great humility and respected very much the theater.
Mm-hmm.
Because in a theater, it's a moment of truth where you're in front of a public. And when you do films, you have a certain solitude. You reach millions of people. But the moment I saw it myself, you are alone with the camera. You don't feel the public. This is why many great film actors like the theater, because they like to play before
connection.
The public. They have a feeling there is a...
Yeah.
We live with the public, you know?
A very good question here is, can mime exist as part of today's theater, or is it condemned to be a unique part of theater history?
Mime? Part
yes.
Of
can mime? Now, Stephanie Salter says meme. Do you want me to say meme or mime?
Mime. It's fine.
Mime. I mean, I felt a little pretentious with the meme thing, so I didn't know how to do that. Okay. Can mime exist as part of today's theater, or is it condemned to be a unique part of theater history?
It's part of history. In the
but
theater.
Can it exist today?
Yes, I think now becomes stronger now than it was. Because when it did arrive in America, the street mimes were imitated Marceau. But of course it hurt a little the profession, because when kids, thousands of kids were imitating Chaplin, but Chaplin was a star in movies, and the kids in the streets imitating bad Chaplin,
mm-hmm.
It was a great tribute to Chaplin,
well,
and nobody, it didn't hurt Chaplin. But when people have not seen Marcel Marceau in the theater and see joke people making mechanical movements, then they say, this is mime. And then a certain moment, it was not so popular. But I cannot blame those kids, because it's better to be a mime in the street than to mug people. Do you say this?
Mm-hmm. To mock people. Uh-huh.
Or to be violent.
Mug people. Oh, yeah. It's
mug
better.
People.
Yes.
Yeah.
Far
you
better.
Know, you must understand that I am French. You
oh,
know?
Is that it? Oh.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, when you see mimes in the park and all of that, they don't have the emotion that you bring to the
no.
art.
Mime has changed and has become a strong force. I tell you why. There was imitation at the beginning. Then certain kids thought if they put on a white face, they are mimes. And then they did mechanical movement because they had no grammar. And when you have no grammar, you cannot practice an art form. There's a grammar for musicians,
mm-hmm.
for dancers, for actors. They have to learn how to speak.
Hmm.
The school is very important. Then, today, they have good schools of mine. For instance, I was taught by Etienne de Croux. I was in the company of Barrault, and I created my own school, which exists since 20 years. And I did many workshops in America, in Ohio, in Ann Arbor, in New York, and young Americans come from all the country, and they want really to learn it. And they learn the grammar, like you learn the grammar of dance, because America has great dancers, classical and contemporary dancers. Mm-hmm. Contemporary dancers.
Yes.
And then they learn the technique and they improve, and now you would be surprised to see how it progressed. American mimes now start to respect the art form, to become deeper, and the public will see that it's not only Marcel Marceau, the mime.
Do you tell your students they have to see, like, let's just do something simple. I mean, just something simple, like a cage, you know, the whole
no.
cage. I mean, do they have to see it?
No, but let me tell you, when I do the cage, you see, this disturbs me. I have a black thing like, again, my nose. Yeah. When you do this, it is not just to do this, it's to have the feeling of this when you do. Then you breathe the movement. When you breathe the movement, it's musical. This is why when musicians come, many musicians, they say, do you sing Marcel Marceau in silence? I say, yes. Because life is a wave, silence is... The communication we have with telephones is with the waves. And the silence does not exist. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And this is why we have to add the breathing.
Breathing. It's breathing it.
And you have to be musical.
Uh-huh. You have to be musical because you breathe it. Oh, man, I'm
breathing
learning a lot here. This is great.
For instance, I give an example. Not only this. There are many examples. For instance, I will draw a third. Do you hear me?
Is you will, fine? You will, but you will.
If I do this, I just make a movement.
I'll draw a sword.
But if I
okay.
do, you see. If I do this, it's nothing. If I do this, and this is,
oh Lord,
and this is the contradiction. Let me give you another example, which
Please
is important.
Do.
When for the first time I was in America, the exercises I did, like walking in the wind. Or the stairs. We have a little spot here, but you know, we'll manage. When I walk against the wind, I do this.
That's walking against the wind.
It's like the moonwalk.
That's where he got it. He got it from you.
Now, when I go upstairs and downstairs, I will do...
Upstairs and downstairs.
The Chinese say the yin and the yang. Push and be pushed. Tirer, pousser. You know this, for instance? And of course, you have to create first the technique.
The technique.
With the four elements. Air, breathing the air, wind, water, fire, and of course, what is the fourth
no,
element?
No, that was four.
Water,
yeah.
Air.
Breathing.
No,
water,
no.
Water, fire.
And the fifth element, time.
Time. Time. When I saw you the other night, Bip did a time in a porcelain factory. And it was Bip in the porcelain factory. And Bip climbs up to the top of the porcelain.
Oh, yes. It,
and it was so wonderful because he climbs up and then the ladder starts going like this. And he's holding the porcelain. And everybody in the audience saw the ladder, saw the porcelain, and was holding their breath that you were going to drop this thing.
But you know, we'll tell you something important also. You are not funny when you want to be funny. What I learned from Chaplin and Keaton, everybody laughed. They were in tragic situations. When you are sliding over a banana peel and falling, people laugh, but not the person who is on the floor, you see. And I learned that you can be tragic in funny situations. Tragedy is there when there is no issue. When you really do die or something happens, but when you do this, yeah. You are not going to laugh. You know, you see. But, you see, this is why all these adventures, which you see with Keaton, with Chaplin, they were great masters, and they learned us. But their art came from the English musical, mm-hmm. And my art comes from the theater. The man who taught me was a great grammarian, in a sense where instead of playing like the French Pierrot, we don't know the grammar Pierrot left. Pierrot was in 19th century, and he did gestures which would be conventional, but it was a grammar too, but it was lost. They had no videos at that time, wow. And unfortunately they didn't write about the grammar. Then Decroux went back to the Greek-Roman statuary. Influenced by the Greek statuary, he called it statuaire mobile statuary. Influenced by Rodin, the great sculptor, mm-hmm. Isadora Duncan, who was a dancer, she was English or American?
American from San Francisco. American.
Yes. Yeah. And this made the grammar of the whole body, for the face, for the neck, for the hands. And then when I left Decroux, I did my own style. Decroux had not the cage. He didn't have it, the grammar. But then when I created my school, I said, the more the students will have technique, the more they will learn the craft of an art form. Mm-hmm. And then the grammar of Decroux entered in my school. I decided, because it was my school, we are subsidized by the Tower of Paris when Chirac was mayor of Paris before being president. And then I decided to create a grammar of Decroux and of Marceau. And through this synthesis, I have now a great force in grammar. And I predict next year is 2000, the Art of Mime will be a strong force in the theater.
Ah, that's wonderful.
This is legacy, which is important.
You know, I was the good news about Hollywood, new Hollywood movies appealing to this 12-year-old sensibility is that maybe there'll be more mime use because they're certainly not writing scripts.
No,
so maybe there's a good news there, you know?
This is absolutely true. I played in America before 2,000 children. And I said, my God, there was much noise before. And I said, oh, la, la. Because when we play in the light goes out, it's black, they will scream, what will happen? It was fantastic. They laughed at the right moment. They were silent at the right time. And I did not play for children. I was with them like they would be grown-up people. And they feel that they get involved, and that we respect them. Mm-hmm. I don't like to play for a child and to become a child, you see?
Right, right.
You see, you have to play for a child, like when they hear a concert or when they see a film. Mm-hmm. Not a violent film, of course. This is another problem.
Not violent movies, no.
But I say poetry, the actors play really for everybody. Mm-hmm. And when I do mime, I play for grown-up and children, the same program, and children are, even when they don't understand it, mm-hmm. they have a fantastic feeling of what is right.
Yeah. Oh, I was a child who saw you. You brought us up to it, and it was magic. It's such an honor to be talking to someone who had such a big influence on me loving show business. Do you consider it show? That's okay to say show business, right? It is show business, isn't it?
No, it's not show business.
Oh.
No. Now tell me, no, be very honest. I respect show business, of course. I was a great admirer of Red Skelton, mm-hmm. with whom I teamed several concerts in Miami. I did with him. And Danny Kaye.
Oh, yes.
Jerry Lewis.
Jerry
also.
Lewis,
And had the greatest respect for slapstick, if it's well done. But I am more a man of the theater, like Chaplin came from musical, but when he did movies, he went deeper and deeper. And then you can compare him to high comedy, you know? Mm-hmm. But let me tell you an adventure which arrived to me when I played with Red Skelton. You know Red Skelton, of course.
Yes.
Yeah. It was fantastic. I had to play Pinocchio, and he was Beppo. Beppo is a man who creates Pinocchio. If I am like this, you see a red nose. I put it here. No, a black nose.
So Geppetto, yeah.
When I speak, do you hear the voice here?
You better speak a little closer to the microphone.
Because
that would be wonderful.
It's a great technique, huh? I'm not accustomed to it. Okay. And I was in a trunk. We were rehearsing. And Pinocchio, you know the story of Pinocchio.
Right.
I was in a trunk, wood trunk. And then he was chopping the tree. But there were slices of trees. It was all prepared. He had a real axe. And it was chopping until he heard it was Pinocchio mm-hmm. in the tree. He's part of the tree. And I said to myself, oh, my God. He does this with a real axe. And I was here with my nose.
Uh-huh.
And what will happen if the axe falls from the handle?
Handle.
See? And it happened. You will see. And he was a great prop man. Let me see. This is absolutely true. I was like this. The public was there. We went television. It was rolling. And it was... And the moment the axe is on over my nose, I hear, oh, God. And the axe fell from... And in the same moment, he did... Whoop, he catch it, and he put it back. And I said, God save. And then, after the show, we spoke about it, and I said... You are really fantastic. How could you be so quick? The axe falls. He said, you know, when an axe falls, it's always slower at the beginning. Like, up, boom, and it falls. And you have just to pick the time, you know. And I learned this from Keaton, because Keaton, unfortunately, when he was middle-aged, had not the success he had when he was young.
That's right.
He had big problems in life, and he was... the prop man of MGM. And he learned to Red Skelton to use props.
So he taught Red Skelton about that, use props. Because Keaton had already fallen on bad times because of financial loss and alcoholism.
Well.
Oh, very sad. Yeah, very interesting. I didn't realize he was a prop man and teaching.
This is legacy.
Yes, it was his legacy. It carried on. What did you think of Red Skelton's technique?
Wonderful. He was light. He said to me, Marcel, I will show you the shortest pantomime. I said, oh, yes, I would like to see it. He did. Great clown is able to work with nothing, and he does, but he is deep. Even when I said before, doing this.
Remember Red Skelton had those two seagulls, Gertrude and Heathcliff? Do you remember he had these two seagulls he created? And, oh boy, what a, you could see them, you could feel them. Every time I saw a seagull, I would think of these
two. Red Skelton had great humility. Mm. And if you wish to see, I don't know if those films I did with him will be revived. But it was really, I learned very much also from him to see how he was light in a movement. And he did another pantomime, which was very funny. A man trains for boxing. And it would be great training, great movement. Mm-hmm. And he rises, and goes, and then, boom! You see, they were short stories.
Yeah.
And this is the art of musical. This is true, you see?
You know who loved pantomime was Jackie Gleason. Jackie Gleason,
yes,
used to do The Poor Soul. Do you
he
all
came
remember?
Also
it was all
to the
pantomime.
Show. Yes, Jackie Gleason also. Yes.
And he did Gigot, the film?
Yeah, he was a good actor, too.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's about acting. And this is a question from one of our people here at the Commonwealth Club. What did your parents think when you told them you wanted to go into mime? Were they aware of it? Were they already... Your parents, growing up in France, they were already gone when you decided to take this on as a career?
My father, unfortunately, was deported and never came back. He didn't see the beginning of my career. He didn't know that I would be a mime and I would be in the theater. My mother, yes, because she had a long life. But I think that it's very difficult to speak about the problems of a family. I was born in Strasbourg, which is at the border of Germany and France. And when the war broke out, we were in 48 hours, we had to leave the town. And to leave even all furnitures, Strasbourg was empty completely. And it took us 3 days, 2 nights maybe, 2 days, 2 nights. We were sent to Périgueux, which was the sud-ouest of France. And, of course, then we were there during the war in the occupation. And I told you the story and the underground, mm-hmm, and what they did in the underground. Mm-hmm. And then I was... the Gestapo was after me. And this is why,
yes,
I had to change my name.
Ah, because the Gestapo was after me.
This is another story. It was like this. I was in danger, and the cousin, who was very important in the French underground, and said, we have to save Marcel Marceau because he will... Marcel, because it was... I will say my real name. You will know it. Mm-hmm. We have to save Marcel because he will play an important part in the theater after the war. I don't know how he sensed it. And, of course, as my father was deported, my brother was in the French Maquis, this also the underground, living in the forest, you know. Mm-hmm. This is a French word. Do you know it in English? Maquis?
Well,
the French underground.
The underground,
yes.
Yeah.
And my mother said, if Marcel entered the underground, I die. You know, he's my little son. And then my real name is Marcel Mangel. M-A-N-G-E-L. Marcel Mangel. And my brother, who was forging papers, said to me, you have to have the two initials, we are the same, M.M. What name will you choose? I said, oh my God, what choose? Marceau. Why Marceau? Because Victor Hugo, you know all Victor Hugo?
Victor Hugo.
Victor Hugo wrote a poetry where he says during the French Revolution, when Napoleon was fighting the battles of Italy after, mm-hmm, the revolution, mm-hmm, he had young generals. And one general was called Séverin Marceau. But Victor Hugo wrote in a poem, le général Hoche on the Adige. Adige is in Italy. Marceau on the Rhine. C'est vrai, Marceau. I said, I am born on the Rhine. My name is Marceau. And we shall kick out the Germans from France. You see, well, this was a statement of a 20-year-old man whose dream was to kick out the Germans from France, you know?
Yes.
And then my name stayed after the war. I said, now I am Marcel Marceau, and I keep that name. Voilà. This is the story of Marcel Marceau.
Well, we've reached the point where we have no more time, only for one more question, which is, do you ever feel like talking? And he talks in a thousand ways. We just have to listen. And we're so glad you were with us today, the great artist, Marcel Marceau.
I know that time has gone. Is it already
yes.
1 hour?
Yes, it is.
You
yes.
see, everything is relative.
Time, yes, breathing.
This hour is for me 5 minutes. You see, because I'm accustomed so much to students and to explain them an art form and to go deeply in theorizing also. And this is why time is timeless for me. Except when you play on the stage, you have to have the real time. Now, let me thank you very much to have been able to talk to you.
Thank you. Merci.
And you have been wonderful. And I realize that it was too short. Because it was too short, because it's wonderful to have a contact with the public, and I think something very important. We have a wonderful success in San Francisco.
Yes.
We are sold out since we are entering the third week and there are no more tickets left. And makes me happy and sad. Because I say it would be so wonderful to have moments with questions about an art form, to speak about life, and you have a real contact with the public in America. And this is why it was a great pleasure to be here. And next time, if you invite me, we shall have 2 hours, maybe.
All right. Thank you. The great Marcel Marceau. Marcel Marceau. He just asked me if I wanted to walk against the wind. Oh, do I ever. So just 1 second. On behalf of the Commonwealth Club of California, I want to thank Marcel Marceau for joining us. Thank you all for attending. We look forward to seeing you at our other programs. And to keep it all official, we are now adjourned. Here are the three gavel signs.